The Big Web Show, everything web that matters. The show is hosted by Jeffrey Zeldman and Dan Benjamin. That's me. This episode is sponsored by MailChimp, powerful email marketing. Build and manage your email lists, design killer HTML email campaigns, and send emails with confidence. You can sign up for a free account and store up to 500 subscribers and send up to 3,000 emails a month. MailChimp's new location-based technology gives you the power to send email campaigns that include geotargeting, locally timed delivery, auto-translation, and more. Visit MailChimp.com/5x5 to find out about special deals just for Big Web Show listeners. So this is episode number 15 of The Big Web Show, everything web that matters, as my co-host Jeffrey Zeldman is fond of saying. Hey, Jeffrey, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Dan. How are you?
Doing well. We have an excellent guest. Perhaps we can you can introduce her.
We have an amazing guest. Tara Hunt is a social media entrepreneur. She co-founded one of the first and most respected social media agencies called Citizen Agency with Chris Messina. She's the author of The Woofy Factor, a book really for not so much for web designers as for people who own websites and who own businesses to try to figure out important community and social media strategies so that they can take advantage of these wonderful opportunities and not be trapped in amber and in a museum somewhere. And she's also one of Fast Company's Women in Tech, 9 thought leaders who are changing our ideas about technology. And today, Tara, I don't know if you saw this, someone just put out the 100 most awesome women on Twitter, and it was better than that. It was like somehow like
powerful.
There, that's a good word. And you were number 13 out of 100, which was I think pretty fabulous. So let's get right to it. You're a social media consultant. Is that accurate? What would you call yourself?
No.
No, I'm totally wrong.
Well, first of all, I don't use social media ever in my title. And consultant, I don't consult anymore. I'm actually a co-founder of a startup that's about to launch.
Okay, we're going to talk about that. But when you were a consultant, right? Mm-hmm. When you weren't a consultant and you weren't in social media. So, what did you call it? What were you? What was Citizen Agency?
Citizen Agency started before the term social media was coined.
Right.
And I was never really incredibly comfortable with that, the term social media consultant, social media agency.
Sure.
I've been in marketing now, or I was in marketing consulting for a good 10 years. And I think when we started Citizen Agency, I was at year 7. And so I had focused a lot on online, but mostly we were looking at how you build relationships with your customers and, you know, your key, your key users, people, your evangelists, the people that are already in love with your product and helping them rock. So,
How did you start the company? What led you to start the company?
I was working at a startup called Ria. And now it's called like.com. So they do shopping search now. But at the time, they were doing automatic tagging of your photos. So face recognition that would automatically tag your photos. And so I had launched Ria to like crazy success. Over 1 million photos within 24 hours, 20,000 users signed up like day one. Within 3 months, we had 10 million photos and I think 80,000 users. Like, and the technology was even kind of broken. So it really surprised me. But what I did with that particular company is I had been talking for a long time on my blog about the way I think marketing should be, right? It really should be about this interaction, conversations now overused, but at the time it was pretty new. I called it kind of community marketing in a way that, you know, you get people involved that were really enthusiastic about the idea from the beginning, give them a lot of power and control and voice in helping you build. And that's what we did at RIA, and it was hugely successful. And so we launched, and it was big, exciting fanfare. And then at the time, I was talking with Chris, who was about to leave Flock, and we just thought it would be really great to apply. And he had done sort of similar with Flock, and we just thought as a team it would be a great way for us to come together and teach companies a new way of marketing that respected and put the customers first. It was revolutionary back then. Now it's pretty much the way people talk.
Now, I want to keep on with this, but I don't want to miss something important, which is, how did you get 10 million photos in an hour? How did you get a million users in 5 minutes or whatever? What accounted for that? What did you use? Any techniques? I mean, there weren't that many people on Twitter, if Twitter even existed at
Twitter
the time.
Didn't exist.
Right. So how did you... I mean, and Horse Pig Cow is your blog, but I don't know what kind of readership it gets, but what accounted for this instant success that you then were able to parlay into other successes and into a kind of bully pulpit for this fledgling social media, which you don't like that phrase, but that's how people think of it.
That's how people
think or marketing 2.0, which I think is a worse phrase, but
It is worse. Yeah.
How did you get so successful so quickly?
It was interesting because for 6 months, so they hired me, RIA had hired me 6 months before the launch. I was unknown. I was actually living in Toronto at the time. They moved me and my son down to San Francisco, and Horse Pig Cow had like 500 readers, I think it was. But, you know, I hit the valley, and for the first time in my life, and it's interesting, as the transformation was going on with me, it was really helping my company. And for the first time in my life, I was surrounded by people who were excited about the same things that I was excited about, like this whole social web geek thing, right, that was going on. And so I went to everything. I went to everything that I possibly could, met as many people. I didn't even really talk about the company that I was with, other than, you know, when I talked about, you know, the excitement around tagging your own photos. But I made friends with the enemies, right? What was seen as possible competition, right? Like Flickr.
Like Flickr, right.
And Picasa and some people from there. You know, we tried to get together and do some web standards things around media. I was just present in the community, but in a way that, you know, people just started to trust me, I guess, and by extension, they were trusting RIA and interested in what we were doing. And they watched also, because I was blogging like, oh, you know, I'm stuck on this particular thing, or we're stuck with these ideas, and all these, you know, I was really, really open and transparent about everything that was going on behind the scenes at this
little Is that good
startup.
Advice generally, to be open and transparent? Would you advise that for most businesses or most people running startups?
Yeah, well, trust is important these days, especially, you know, like over the last couple of years, the trust has been absolutely thrown out the window between companies and customers, and all sorts of ratings of trust have gone down. People don't feel as loyal anymore. And so when you build when you show what's happening behind the scenes, and people start to really feel like they know you and they know what's happening and they can see when you screw up and you admit when you screw up and all this different stuff, they start to really trust you. And when they trust you, they like you. And when they like you, they want to give you the benefit of the doubt in different situations. So definitely. I mean, I think... not to say that they would have necessarily pulled through this any better, but, you know, if BP over the years had built better trust, then I think probably more people would have given them the benefit of the doubt and then wanted to go out and help them with the cleanup. So that sort of thing. So I think in any industry, that transparency leads to trust, for sure.
How do you convince corporations to be more transparent, more honest? I mean, we kind of have many decades of corporate culture that are about control and hiding what's going on, really going on at the company. It's not unique to BP or, you know, whatever conspiracy you want to mention. It's the way we do business that we know that the cars are going to kill people, but we release them anyway and we pay some lawsuits when people die. I mean, that's been the way we do business for a very long time. So how do you go about making the social change, right? Because there's like positive social change if businesses stop doing that. It's not just good for business, right?
Yeah. Well, and I think it is good for business, and I think that's what a lot of businesses miss. They only see the positive social change, and they're like, well, our board members aren't going to be signing up for that. But it is good for business ultimately. And every fiber of my being is dedicated to changing this. So that's why I moved from consulting to writing a book, thinking writing a book would be a really great way to get the message out further. You know, there's a certain cachet associated with books, right? And so if I wrote a book and I put it out there, that things would change faster. And then the book came out, and I get really awesome, inspirational messages almost daily from people who have read the book who are like, I gave this to my CEO and he's finally listening to me. Things like that, which make me feel like that was a worthy way to go forward. But that wasn't even fast enough for me. So that's why I'm doing the startup now, which really gives consumers a lot of power. It's all about giving the customers power over the corporations, which I think will change things ultimately because the customers hold the wallets.
Tell us about the startup. What is it?
And I didn't come on the program to pitch, but it's called it's called Schwelp, and it's all about
Schwelp.
Schwelp, wow in shop.
Wait, Schwelp?
Yeah, like Dwelp, like Schwelp.
can you spell it? I'm just like,
it's schwowp.com. I'm showing those of us who are watching on the video. They'll be able to see this. S-H-W-O-W-P.
Schwab.
That's right. Yeah. That's what you said.
Schwab.
That's right.
I just, anyways, do you know what? It'll be a household name any day now. But anyways, the point of it is really ultimately to give customers all of their shopping data and then tools in order to leverage that data for change, for better deals, for better search results, for better whatever. We think that data is very powerful, and we see things like this new right click by Visa and the way that all the credit card companies and all these different, I think the Wall Street Journal had a big article recently on how we're being tracked and watched through cookies online. I mean, there's a lot of data being amassed by our behavior, but we don't know, and we don't have that in our control to do anything with. And Schwab is all about democratizing that data, putting it back into people's hands and giving them the tools to do cool stuff with it. What cool stuff? I think that is the question. We have some ideas, but I think that will unfold with our community.
So this is giving me control over my cookies, essentially. So
No.
Am I browsing through a Schwab browser and it says, the site you're visiting knows that you buy Levi's jeans. Do you want it to know that? I mean, does it work like that?
No, but that would be really cool too, and I encourage anybody to create a plugin for your browser to do that. But no, we're structuring it like TripIt does.
Okay.
So for those of you who know TripIt, you get your travel plans sent to you via email, and you forward it to Plans at TripIt, and it puts it in a nice, simple itinerary for you. Well, the same thing, you get your order confirmations, and you forward it to wow@schwelp.com, and you get not an itinerary, but a overall listing of your history of shopping as you build it. And we're also going to be building in that people can authenticate to their various different email accounts, starting with Gmail, and it can go back through some history and pull that data in.
Is that so? I don't go to the site; I send stuff to the site.
Right. You can go to the site to augment the data, to take a look at your statistics. We're going to do some fun infographics.
Like a carbon profile kind of thing.
Yeah, or do you like things like mashing up your shopping patterns with, you know, the weather in your area? Do you shop more or less when it rains? Well, you know, do you splurge more, or do you look for deals? You know, that sort of thing. You know, save for a rainy day kind of fun stuff. Maybe even with, you know, political climates, that sort of thing.
So OkCupid analyzes pictures and says, you know, men who don't smile get more dates, or that kind of thing.
Yeah, well, and I would love to, you know, in the future, allow people to hook in there if they use OkCupid or Hunch or whatever, and start to analyze their own shopping patterns, you know, cross-referencing with their other behavior in other places as well. But, you know, the caveat to this is that we're very committed to making this data all wholly portable and exportable. And so, concurrent to working on, you know, creating this fun stuff for people to do at Schwelp, we're also going to be working on semantic commerce and stuff, so that we can start to create a bit of a standard when it comes to marking up the order confirmations and various different products and stuff, et cetera. And there's already some work done on the Microformats wiki, which is very cool.
Right.
But there's definitely a lot more work to be done in that area. Plus, there is getting the big players to buy in.
So, like Google.
Google, Amazon, Bluefly.
So this is a big topic. I mean, a lot of people listening to this are thinking, well, this is great. This is a cool idea. How do you do that? How do you get the big players involved? I mean, how do you get their interest? Obviously, it's a neat idea. You can pitch it to them, but what takes that to the next step where they say, yeah, I'm interested in this. I'll play on this playing field.
I'm assuming no big players are watching this. So, or if they are, they have like a very open mind to this stuff. But the way we're kind of thinking of it is, you know, this is why we're building Schwelp for customers and not for vendors. Is because we think if we have enough of a enthusiastic customer community on Schwelp that's affluent and influential, that's going to move the vendors in that direction.
Sure.
The power to the people. That's what democratization is all about. So that's my assumption.
Right. So we've got 20 million people with disposable income. We've got 20 million people who all own iPads and they'd like to shop at your site. But it would help them if you would mark up your shopping cart using these semantics.
Not only that, is like, oh, so you want to read their data? Well, then you're going to have to reciprocate by marking up your data to like match how their data is marked up.
It's a company giving away its stuff in return. Like, okay, you know how much. You know that I just bought a car, but I know that your markup at your store is 50%, and that the company that made the product actually got a dollar for it. You know, the initial manufacturer got a dollar for it. Is it going to be like that? Truly reciprocal? Probably not.
Well, so I think our assumptions are that you start showing people that as open as we can be is actually beneficial for everybody. That is going to be a nice slippery slope for people to jump onto and slide down, I guess, is my hope anyways. We're really hoping that, one of the incentives for customers is going to be, you have your, it's like saying, here's your data package. If you can start bartering in a way, you can go to, if you are buying a car, you can go to all the different car companies and say, I have this package of data. I'm sending out my personal RFP. That company with the best offer back for my data gets to read my data, get a really good idea of who I am, give me not only a better deal because I've given you my data, but also a better experience, and increase your chances of making a sale to me. Which, when it comes to marketing budgets for all these different companies, I think any marketing director would be overjoyed to hear that they could spend less per customer acquisition.
But you're not going to be shopping through Schwab. You're not going to, because it sounds to me a little bit like Expedia or something like that. It sounds like a front end where you have all these vendors and, or hotels.com. When you're saying I'm sending out data to see where I get the best deal or where I get the most trustworthy partner, provider. How are you doing that if not through a website or an app? Are you going to have a Schwab app?
That stuff is down the road. I mean, we're starting with allowing people to amass their data. So we'll figure out what the best route is to be able to package that data up and send it out. I mean, at first, the assumption is that vendors will start coming to us. People can, in a way, shop around Schwab, because if they're starting to share and add people to their Schwab account, then you can actually start to see what other people are buying and click on it and go and purchase it yourself. Same thing is, like, you can also share it to Facebook and Twitter if you want certain purchases. So you can do that, and we are hoping that vendors will come and start to make those offers. But yeah, eventually we're going to have to find a way to take those packages and deliver them outside of Schwab.
And you have semanticians working for you? Do you have programmers on staff or semanticians on staff? How have you partnered with people like Tontic or Eric Meyer to dream this stuff up?
Tontic would be awesome, and Eric would be awesome too. We've hired a PhD from MIT that has been designing our email parsing system, and he'll probably come back and design that app. We have a small team of developers right now, and we're in the midst of hiring a designer, and hopefully that's going to finish up by the end of this week, because design is very important to us, especially user experience stuff.
When does this thing come out? You're getting us ready to see this. I mean, obviously, you've got a lot of experience in this space of launching things and giving advice to companies about how to build up excitement. So you're good at that. When does this thing actually come out?
That's a good question. So I have a lot of experience on the advice part, and even working with the team at RIA and launching. But I've never been the CEO breathing down the necks of the developers before. This is kind of a odd new role for me, and I'm trying to figure that out. But they were doing a really private, with our we did a friends and family round of investments, so that group plus, a few select others, because the design isn't going to be ready yet. It's just going to be like playing with the technology on a kind of a meh interface, or standard interface. So that'll be in, I think, 10 days now, is the, oh, wow, the projected, wow, launch.
So that's very soon. I mean, that's right around the corner. So let me interrupt what you're saying for a second and ask you about that. You mentioned this is a transition for you. You're going from a role where you have been brought in as an expert and said, okay, tell us what to do. And now you said you're CEO of this thing, you're running this thing. What does it take to make that kind of a transition? I mean, when you had the original idea, was this the role that you had sort of imagined for yourself?
Okay, so what it takes to make this kind of transition is absolute naivety. That's not really knowing what you're getting. It's like having kids, right? Then all of a sudden you're like, oh, it's not just like playing dolls in house. There's a lot of work involved. Yeah. And there's doing a lot of things that you did not, you nobody told you about. And, you know, people say it's hard work, but you don't really understand what kind of hard work. Certainly there's long hours and you're focused on it all the time, but there's the biggest part of it is like doing things like pitching to friends. That's weird for me. I'm used to being the person that buys the rounds of drinks, you know, and says, you know, let's go do karaoke. And then all of a sudden I'm like, so I know you have a bit of money kicking around. What do you say? You know, that's weird for me to be in that role. I'm much more comfortable giving than I am taking or asking to take.
But your friends have money. That's kind of nice, you know?
Yeah. Oh my God. It's amazing. My friends are fabulous and they've been super supportive through this process.
But that has to take a lot of courage, Tara, to be able to go to somebody who's a friend or a family member. You know, you always hear people saying, oh, you know, you said it 5 minutes ago. Oh, we did a friends and family raise and, you know, we've got that done. I mean, that actually seems more challenging and difficult to me, asking friends and family for money in a way, than trying to get angel investment or VC investment. Although they usually say that the friends and family is the first, you know, and best step. What was that like? And how do you get advice on how much you need to raise? How do you structure all of this?
I have an amazing one of my co-founders who's taken on the role as COO, Cassandra Gerard. She is so amazing at structuring this stuff and figuring out what we need to raise for whatever period of time before we go back into the pit and do that seed/angel round of fundraising, which I'm also not looking forward to, but I think I've gotten my, you know, gotten a little bit more experience, so I'm getting better at it. And she's made this much, much easier for me. I think if I was to give anybody advice on going forward into something like this, it's, you know, the team of people that you get together with, complementary strengths is fantastic. It's going to make you fight at times over, you know, philosophy. So I want a new iPad because I think we should test an app on an iPad. Cassandra's like, no, it's not in the budget yet. So, it's just really good to have people with those sort of different skill sets as well as outlooks on things. So she's very business focused, very operations focused. She's got the budget down to the last penny. She's got all the legal documents ready for. So I get to do this. I get to say, hey, so we're having a few drinks, friend, and I know you have some money kicking around. This is what we're doing. What do you think? And the friend goes, hey, I'm interested in hearing more. And then I get to put them on the phone with Cassandra, who takes them, she's the closer, who takes them through the next steps. And
what I kind of hear you saying is that it's critical to have maybe not necessarily co-founders, although we've been given, you know, in the past on this show, a lot of people who come on who've started something say it's important to have a co-founder, but is that what's key, or is it just being able to have good people around you that can do the things that you're not maybe as good at?
Yeah, good people around you, for sure. The extra sort of cherry on top with the co-founders is they're as invested in what you're doing as you are. So, to be a co-founder, basically you're saying, yes, I'd like to work on this project, but for no money. And long hours and really taking all the risks without any without any guaranteed rewards.
So how much of a risk is this for you personally? I mean, obviously your reputation's on the line in making something like this a success, but do you feel like you're in a good situation knowing that, I mean, I know the people who are successful say never think about a fallback plan, but you know, do you have a fallback plan if something like this works, or is this something that you're just planning on being successful? What's the right attitude to have, in other words, when you go into something attitude. Like this? Yeah.
So having no fallback plan, that's an interesting piece of advice, because I don't have a fallback plan. And so that makes me wake up in the middle of the night with really great ideas all the time to push things forward, instead of like having peaceful night's sleep and sleeping in and being all like la-di-da about it. I think it gives me a good sense of urgency, but not so much that that I'm, you know, I'm going to make panicked, bad decisions. And I think the same with my co-founders. All three of us, Jerome, Cassandra, and myself, are, you know, we're basically not paying ourselves. We've put all of the money that we have, you know, in the bank into this project. And we're spending all of our time on it. Occasionally, if I need to have a little extra cash, I'll take a speaking gig. Jerome will take a consulting gig, and so will Cassandra. But you know, we've committed a certain amount of hours to making this work. Because if any of us get too comfortable outside of it, we know that things will fall apart. So it's an interesting balance. And none of us are like 21 and fresh out of school. I'm an empty nester now. My son just moved out, but I've been a single mom for a long time, so I have responsibilities. Jerome has a wife, and you know, they still have the idea of having kids in their future, and Cassandra's has a boyfriend. She doesn't have kids in her future, but she still has. She's in her 30s. It's not like any of us, you know, are okay with sleeping on a mattress in a house of six people anymore, right?
So right.
We have to work a little harder to keep our lifestyles a little.
The dumpsters behind restaurants are pretty good, I find. If things don't work out, I'm just saying.
Yeah, thanks.
Well, you make a really interesting point, though, in that typically whenever you think of a startup, especially in today's startup space in technology on the web, you always do imagine young people in their early 20s usually, who are all sleeping in a one-room apartment writing code at a coffee shop during the day. How do you have this structured? Are all of your developers in one place? Are you together in an office? What paint a picture of what this is like, that this startup environment that you're creating?
Well, Jerome already had an office for his consulting firm that has a lease still left on it for just over another year, I think. So we gather in there 3 days a week. And we're not fussy with our developers or the people that are consulting with us. They can work remotely if they need to, but we do ask them to come in and work side by side with us. You know, once a week would be nice, even if the days that we're there. We find that a lot of out of the office time together is really good too. It's amazing what Montreal has a really great startup scene. A lot of people don't know this, and there's probably three or four events a week. So we make sure we go as a team to these events, and it gives us a chance that, you know, we're out talking with people. And of course, because it's a startup scene, we're all talking about our startups, and other smart people will give us really great ideas or feedback. And then we're there together to come together right after whatever the event, and, you know, either go for dinner or for a drink, and then take some napkins and write down some more ideas, and also follow up with contacts and doing that sort of thing. So social time together is really important. But I'm like very much like when I get into like a mode, I know as one of the founders of the co-working movement, having quiet space is really important to me, which is kind of opposite of co-working. I like the energy of being in the office, but I like those 2 days a week because I find I'm really productive outside of the office too, at my dining room table at home.
Where are you now? Is that where you are now?
I'm at my dining room table at home, yeah.
So one of the things I definitely wanted to talk to you about today was the whole co-working movement. I mean, I don't think there are as many people who've been kind of as vocal and involved in spreading the word about co-working and working in different environments and things like that. I think a lot of the people that are in our space, whether they're designers, developers, whatever, a lot of them are sort of working from home. And, you know, I think for many of them, they want to have that social interaction, but you know, they don't necessarily want to do that at 10 p.m. at night in a bar. That's they want to do that the other 10 hours out of the day that they're working. So what was your motivation for starting or being involved in the push for co-working as much as you have been? And how did that tie in with BarCamp?
Yeah.
Well, actually, it has an interesting tie-in. So, you know, once again, going back to, you know, my meeting and starting to work with Chris Messina, when we decided, we had already been meeting. Chris had met Brad Newberg, who was running a co-working space, I think 2 or 3 days a week out of, he was subletting some space out of this women's center called Spiral Muse in the Mission. But I think Brad's projects were taking over, and it was hard for him to do the marketing, getting people down there, and then, you know, maintaining it. And so, you know, Chris had met him and I think wrote a post on how we need to have a permanent space. And shortly thereafter, Chris and I met, and, you know, we sat down with Brad, and Chris asked Brad if it would be okay if we explored the idea of making this a bigger thing and not just a sublease. And Brad was like, that's cool. Like, that's what I've always wanted. I just don't have the time for it because, you know, he's been working on all these big projects. So Chris and I started putting together these meetups around this idea of co-working. We started in Ritual Roasters in San Francisco. And next thing you know, it was a couple months later, and we had a space that still exists. It's called the Hat Factory. It's in Portrayal Hill. Shlomo Rabinowitz, it was his big loft, and he had a section of it that was free. And so we started out there. But Chris and I quickly discovered that although it was really great for the people that, you know, the creative types that worked on their own a lot, we were meeting with clients because we had started Citizen Agency. So we needed more of, you know, less of a living space and more of a little bit more professional space. And so we found Citizen Space. And it was in a building it's still there at 2nd and Harrison. And filled it up pretty much right away. And as we were doing that, we noticed like all these other people getting on our Google group that we had started just for the San Francisco stuff, wanting to do this all over North America and some like in other countries as well. And by the time Citizen Space was like 6 months old, I think there were 30 some odd spaces that had popped up around the world. And now there are, somebody counted the other day. I should pull that up. But there's hundreds of spaces all over the world, more in progress. And the list, the co-working Google group, I think has 2,500 people that are all chattering regularly about different things that arise when running a co-working space, like, should we add an extra desk? What happens when we have an unruly coworker? Things like that, do people pay for coffee here? That sort of thing. So all these really great discussions, and then around philosophy and stuff, and it's become a really strong, amazing community. And how it ties to Barcamp, I mean, other than Chris Messina was also one of the co-founders of Barcamp, is that, one of the things that we like to call co-working was Barcamp every day, because people would go to Barcamp and they would go as independents, and then there would be this amazing exchange of ideas happening sort of serendipitously and just from the right people being in the room. And co-working did that every day. Co-working was about that. It wasn't about, an office rental space where you had closed doors. It was all, this open environment where people exchanged ideas, and who showed up was who was supposed to show up, very much like that open space inspiration of Barcamp.
Nice. I want to circle back for a second, if I can, Tara. Because, again, you were a marketer for 10 years, and now you founded Schwalbe, and you're the CEO, not the marketer. But I wonder, as the CEO and as a longtime marketer, and as someone who's very aware of web communities, how have you formulated plans yet to market Schwalbe? And if you have, do they involve traditional advertising? Are they community-based plans? What are your thoughts?
It's all community-based plans, and it's something that I feel like we're already doing. So, and it's something that I feel like I've been doing for 10 years. So the way that I quite often describe the success at Ria, it's not that I did anything particularly incredible around the launch. It's that I spent 6 months leading up to the launch building a lot of relationships and people who supported what I do and this idea that they heard me talk about. And I got them excited about that idea, and they contributed to that idea actually being launched and happening. So this is what I've been doing with Schwalbe too. I mean, I've been thinking about this idea for, 3 years. Based on this idea called VRM, or Vendor Relationship Management, that movement that was started by Doc Searls, one of the authors of the Clue Train Manifesto.
Right.
And so I've been involved in the VRM community now for 3 years. I've been trying to go to events, the Internet Identity Workshop. I missed the last couple of years of it, but in the beginning I was at the IIW where the VRM group sort of convened. I went and spent a weekend with Doc and his wife Joyce around this idea, and they helped me sketch it out about a year and a half ago, 2 years, I guess 2 years ago now. So I've been very open with the VRM community, getting feedback, doing that, but also in my blog and on Twitter and talking with people, being on podcasts like this, getting feedback from people, being very as open and transparent as I can be without being, dangerous to my co-founders, like with setting too high of expectations, which is to me more of a damaging thing than somebody stealing ideas. So these are all things that I've been doing all along, and we have a little sign up on the splash page, which isn't even our final design, which has attracted I think 1,100 now people signing up wanting to get in on the beta when it comes out.
It's girly. It's pink.
Well, yeah.
you're gonna need a. I think you need a brown one with men fighting and teeth getting knocked out and stuff to get the male consumer. Maybe like, I don't know, porn and car crashes or something, just to get
unlike many startups in our space, I'm not afraid to cater to the female customer because
the shopper.
Because I think statistics show that we're the shoppers. We're also the ones that put a lot more time and thought and need these tools even more. Don't want to alienate men. Don't want to make it too pink. The ultimate design won't be like pink with girly girls with shopping bags for sure. The ultimate design is going to be a little bit more neutral, but definitely always with female shopper in mind. And because that's who I understand, that's we have a male on the team, and he'll be able to push back when it gets too much into my direction, right?
Shlomo and Schwaup, is there any connection?
No, but maybe we should have him as our poster boy.
That would be good.
Shlomo loves Schwaup.
You put the wow in shop.
I put a
C in it. SCH Schwaup.
Yeah, well, it's
so that,
that's
an, it's not. That's wrong.
That's an old.
That's the Israeli version.
Yeah. Well, then it's too close to schmuck, right? So.
Oh my God! There's your male thing right there.
So we'll look for the premiere of your site in the next couple weeks then, and really, really good luck to you there. I think it's going to be very cool. I can't wait to see what this turns into.
Yeah, thank you very much, and thanks for having me on the show. This has been awesome. I'm very honored to be one of your guests.
Thanks again to our guest today, Tara Hunt. Thanks to MailChimp for making this show possible. You can visit them at MailChimp.com/5x5. And thanks to you for listening. You can hear previous episodes of this show and check out all of the shows we produce by visiting 5x5.tv. And if you enjoyed this show, please consider rating it on iTunes. It's the best way to help new listeners find out about the show. This is Dan Benjamin for The Big Web Show. We'll see you again next week.